It is the Banner Ravens podcast. Paul Mancano and Jonas Schaefer. We are live on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter here on this Tuesday morning. Please like, give us a thumbs up, write us a good review. If you do write us a good review on Apple Podcasts, we will read it out on the podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in. Jonas, we are about a week into the new league year. We've got questions about this Ravens roster, about this Ravens offseason. Eight of them, in fact. I'm going to start with a signing in the division that we saw last week that we were live on a podcast for when it broke. And that would be Patrick Queen going to the division rival Pittsburgh Steelers on a three-year deal worth about $41 million. And since he's been introduced, Jonas, he said, quote, "I want to be the villain. I want to be that guy. So I'm looking to do some stuff to them," as in the Ravens. And then hops on Twitter after a bunch of Ravens fans jump to criticize him and says, "It's not even that deep for us players until game week. And y'all can't understand the fact that it wasn't up to me. Go touch some grass and fill the void in your life." Is Patrick Queen a villain now?
Was it Shakespeare who said, you know, either die a hero or live long enough to see yourself become
a villain? I think that's Christopher Nolan, but anyway.
This was always going to end poorly for PQ, right? Because either he goes to Pittsburgh and sucks and Ravens fans let him know about it every week, or he goes to Pittsburgh and is mid and is reminded by Ravens fans about it every week, or he goes to Pittsburgh and becomes a Pro Bowler, all pro, continues the ascent that he was on before Roquan Smith got to Baltimore. I think it's important that we say that he was good and starting to turn the corner before Roquan Smith got to the Ravens. But in the event that he went to Pittsburgh and was like good, then Ravens fans were going to hate on him rationally or irrationally for leaving the Ravens and abandoning, you know, the team that drafted him to go play for the mercenary force, the evil of all evils, the Pittsburgh Steelers. So I think this is just kind of hastening the inevitable. I think there was always going to be this breakoff point with the Ravens fans and Patrick Queen, who like just a month ago, Ravens fans were head over heels for just because he felt like one of their own. He was outspoken. So he has become the villain in a lot of ways. I think he's probably said some things that if I were his PR team, I would not advise him to. I think taking the social media strategy of someone like Geno Stone, who's just like, "Love y'all, I'm out, peace," and then just never commenting on that torture relationship ever again, would probably be the best strategy, and probably is the best strategy for a lot of players. But PQ, as much as I love talking to him, I cannot help but admit that he is seemingly a habitual name searcher on Twitter. And when you do that, you give yourself a lot of reasons to be online, and to be mad online is not a strategy that you or I would advise.
No, it's clear that he has been listening very closely his entire career to what fans have had to say, especially on social media. I do agree with his sentiment of touching some grass. I think a lot of people online who are mad online, this goes to you know, as much to Patrick Queen as it does to the people who are saying bad things about Patrick Queen just because he signed with the Steelers. And also, I thought an important thing in here was him saying, "You can't understand that it wasn't up to me. The players don't have full autonomy when it comes to free agency." And did the Ravens even make an offer? Probably not, because they already have Trenton Simpson waiting in the wings. So it wasn't like Patrick Queen was dying to get out of Baltimore and was eager to play against them. This is what he ended up with, was a contract from the Pittsburgh Steelers that was better than any other deal. So that's where he signed. And so it's not up to him. However, he didn't have to come out in his first answer in that press conference and say he wants to be the villain. Yes, people asking questions sometimes try to get players, egg players on to get them to say something like that. That was pretty much unprompted. I mean, he was just asked about switching sides, and I think he was the first to use the term villain. I don't think somebody said, "Do you want to be the villain?" I think he just offered that term.
Right, right. I mean, are you familiar with the comedic stylings of Drill on Twitter?
Paul? Yes. Yeah, yeah. At Drill, yeah. Wint, yeah.
Can't you see Patrick Queen's career arc over the next couple of years basically becoming the I'm not owned. I continue to insist as I slowly shrink and transform into a corncob. Like, this has the outlines of a very, like, only in the 2020s social media arc, where
yes,
a guy just digs himself further and further, no matter what he does. You know, like he could be an all pro next year. And if in the two Ravens games that he plays, he like misses on a Patrick Queen on a Lamar Jackson tackle, or like can't pick up a fumble and the Ravens win both of those games or even one of those games, it will have been a good decision for the Ravens in the eyes of the Ravens fans not to re-sign him because of those just two plays. So exactly. It is a very, very like only in 2024 hero / villain arc that Patrick Queen is heading on, which is great for us because it gives us something to write about. I mean, like,
it's awesome content. With
all due respect to like CJ Mosley. CJ Mosley was never giving us this kind of content when he left Baltimore for the Jets.
Yeah. All right, Jonas, you've got a question about another player who has left in free agency for a division rival.
Yeah, not as exciting as Patrick Queen, but I think we were at once unsurprised to see Tyler Huntley leave Baltimore, get a deal somewhere else. What was surprising to us was the outline of that deal, the PFF projections for his contract, and the first time that he wasn't a restricted free agency, was 1 year, $4 million. And instead, Tyler Huntley gets a one-year veterans minimum deal, so about like $1.2 million, but it counts even less against the cap, to basically be QB3 / QB3.5 in Cleveland. You know, Deshaun Watson is obviously coming back from that shoulder surgery, but they just signed Jameis Winston to, I think, a one-year $4 million deal. They still have Dorian Thompson-Robinson, who they were pretty high on. I guess the question is, one, the Ravens probably would have been able to re-sign Tyler Huntley if they wanted him, right? And two, would you have done that, or are you just counting on the Ravens to know what they're doing in moving on from what would have been another affordable year of a QB2 and maybe striking out somewhere new with Josh Johnson or Blake Cunningham, or name your quarterback from the draft?
Yeah, I think it's one of two options. It's the Ravens thought that the veterans minimum was too much to pay for Tyler Huntley, or they think that they can do better in free agency or the draft at QB2. Or third option, the door number three, is that they somehow think that Malik Cunningham is good enough to be their QB2. I would suggest they stay as far away from door number three as possible, because Malik Cunningham has never thrown a pass in an NFL game, and he's going to be 25 years old and is an undrafted free agent, which I know so was Tyler Huntley. But I don't think the Ravens in any world can go into next season with their best backup options for Lamar Jackson being Malik Cunningham and Josh Johnson, who is 37, because they need a more stable presence behind Lamar Jackson. Like you said on last week's podcast, Jonas, we're a year away from a lot of hand wringing about Lamar Jackson being able to stay on the field, and you need a suitable backup for every quarterback in the NFL, but especially for Lamar. Maybe they think they can do better with a mid-round pick. I just don't think that any guy that they're going to get in rounds 3 through 6 is going to necessarily be an upgrade in his rookie year over Tyler Huntley. I would have paid that kind of money for Tyler Huntley, but maybe there's another veteran out there that they think they could have. I thought Josh Dobbs honestly made a lot of sense before he signed yesterday with San Francisco. Brilliant guy and so-so quarterback, and might have fit their system as a nice little backup to Lamar. So the options are running out on the free agent market. There aren't a whole lot of proven veterans that are left still out there, unless you want Ryan Tannehill, who is like the polar opposite of Lamar Jackson as a quarterback. So I just am not loving the idea that they're going to go into the draft needing to draft a quarterback and a backup to Lamar between rounds 3 and 6.
Yeah, I mean, Ryan Tannehill is injury prone and would probably exceed the Ravens budget. I mean, the thing that's tricky is just like, you know, they have 9 picks now. That's a lot of picks. And if you're Eric DaCosta, that either gives you up, you know, the arsenal to move up in the draft, and, you know, maybe you're not comfortable picking at number 30 overall. Maybe you want to go up and get a Troy Faiatanu, like, you know, in the lower 20s, as opposed to hanging back and hoping that Tyler Guyton falls to you at 30 or something like that. But that's going to cost some mid-round capital. And maybe with that mid-round capital, you would have otherwise picked a guy like, I don't know, Jordan Travis in the 4th or 5th round. So
I like a lot.
If I were the Ravens, I would be very, very intentional about trying to find a quarterback, especially now that you probably don't need to take a running back, probably don't need to take a defensive lineman in those middle rounds, because you've secured yourself for the near future with Derrick Henry and Justin Madubuike. But, you know, best player available, I guess, is going to dictate how the Ravens want to proceed with their draft.
My next question for you, Jonas, in this Ravens offseason is, if you're Eric DaCosta, you're looking back on the moves you made last offseason, are you regretting the deal you signed with wide receiver OBJ? It was 1 year, $15 million, with four void years on that contract, essentially to lower his 2023 cap hit as low as possible. He was released by the Ravens the other day, and he said on Instagram goodbye to the city of Baltimore, to his teammates. He is carrying a lot of dead money, despite the fact that he's not going to be back in 2024, $2.767 million in dead money this year, and then in 2025, $8.03 million in dead money. How bad does that deal look for a guy that is only going to be in Baltimore 1 year and had fewer than 600 receiving yards for the Ravens?
Paul, you've been covering sports for a while. Have you ever, in the course of your dealings, like, talked to a player or coach or executive who said, again, acknowledged on the record that they regretted something?
No, not once.
Like,
not
regret is intrinsically divorced from the like on the record narrative aspect of sports.
They would never acknowledge it.
There's nothing short of like a capital offense that Odell could have done that would have led Eric DaCosta or anyone who would have assigned him, who would have signed him in an alternate universe, to say like, yeah, this was a mistake.
But if you give them truth serum,
I don't know. I mean, I think they would convince themselves that it was a worthy deal. And like, you know, we've talked about this, I've written about this. You know, he did finish second on the team in yards. Wasn't a whole lot of yards, but he did do it. You know, for a stretch there, he was, you know, one of the more efficient receivers in the NFL in terms of yards per route run. He certainly had some clutch catches. You know, the ESPN receiver tracking metrics has him as a top 30 receiver overall. And then there's just like, you know, the whole Lamar Jackson angle of it all. I guess if you are playing the counterfactual game, then you could say that you could have signed DeAndre Hopkins, who was the other guy who Lamar said, I would like to play with that guy if you're serious about me coming back to Baltimore, and, you know, say that that was the move to make. But OBJ signed with the Ravens in mid-April. D-Hop didn't sign until late July. So I don't know if he was on the kind of timetable that would have allowed for the Ravens to get that deal done with Lamar on the timetable that they did, which was very important for putting together their whole offseason. Remember, like, the introductory press conference for the Lamar stuff basically happened on the day that the draft happened. So it was very important that they get their ducks in a row when they did. So I think it was an excusable signing. Was it an overpay? Yes. But I think everyone that you get in free agency on the open market who's not, you know, one of your own, it's going to be an overpay. That's just the nature of the beast. That's why you see these like above average guards getting $20 million a year when, you know, if you just draft and develop your own, it's a lot more cost-effective way of building your roster.
And you knew that you were going to have to pay a premium because of the name, because OBJ carries cachet and because he helps sell jerseys. However, we saw Eric DaCosta make so many bargain, brilliant moves last offseason. The Jadeveon Clowney signing was a brilliant move. The Kyle Van Noy signing was a great move. These are moves that they got more value than they were paying for. But like you said, Jonas, they waited longer to make those deals. A lot of those guys came later, much later in free agency than OBJ did. And also, it kind of balances out the good with the bad. You know, they knew that they were going to be overpaying for OBJ, but they were hoping that they were going to get more than they were paying for when it came to these periphery guys. And that's what happened. The thing that just frustrates me is we talked all season about OBJ wasn't signed to make catches in September. He was signed to make catches in January. Just wait for the playoffs. Two playoff games, four catches, 34 yards. You can't just expect a light to turn on when it comes to the playoffs.
Just as we wrap this up, like, the OBJ move and merch aspect is something that I think we should underline, because when Eric DaCosta went on with Mike Florio, I think it was in the wake of the whole OBJ signing and Lamar signing, I think last offseason, and Mike Florio asked him about it. I don't know if I've ever heard a team executive acknowledge that the celebrity around a player and the ability of a player to like generate hype, even when that player isn't necessarily in his prime anymore, was a consideration, was something that I've never heard before and might never hear again. Like, just the acknowledgement that, yes, OBJ is a bit of a publicity ploy. We still think he can contribute, but there was a very real consideration that, like, this guy will bring fans to Baltimore who might never otherwise be Ravens fans. So I guess credit to Eric DaCosta for being honest about that, but it was still wild that, like, that was something that was acknowledged openly about the calculus in bringing back Odell.
Look, yeah. If Eric DaCosta can acknowledge that, then maybe he can acknowledge he made a mistake. So, you know, there you go.
Let's not push it. Another guy who is probably not long for Baltimore, Mr. Ronnie Stanley, Gianna Han, did a nice story looking at some of the financial data from his restructured contract, which basically suggests that this is, in fact, the last year of the Ronnie Stanley experience. His salary for 2024 cut from $11 million to $3 million. His original contract had a $4 million roster bonus for this year. If he was still on the team, he's going to get that bonus, but now it is going to be a $1 billion bonus. And 2025 is now a void year. So again, just kind of defraying those expenses over the long haul, even though this is probably Ronnie's last rodeo in Baltimore. So it felt like we were headed toward a situation where Ronnie would take a pay cut to make this team building operation more logical, more, and certainly easier for Eric DaCosta. I don't know that a lot of people thought that the way to do that was just to restructure the deal so that you're basically carving off a year and saying that this is it for you, Ronnie. Do you feel like that was the thing that we should have been expecting all along? Is this the right thing to kind of give up on a player who has been really, really good when healthy, but health has been that bugaboo for him year in and year out?
I think it's entirely fair for the Ravens to be looking to move on from him, because you just can't rely on him going forward, because he's only going to get older and those injury concerns are going to keep piling up. And for them to try to save some money now and turn towards the future and look towards a draft that is, as Eric DaCosta said, very good in terms of offensive line talent and offensive tackle talent, I think it's the right move. And it gives them, obviously, it's not like they cut bait. It gives them still another year of having that veteran presence, especially after they traded their other tackle in Morgan Moses. But it does still create questions. Is the long-term future of this offensive line is totally up in the air. And that leads to our next question, which is, what kind of shape is the Ravens offensive line in at this point? And how can they build towards the future? Because Morgan Moses gone, traded to the Jets. Kevin Zeitler just signed yesterday. So he is out the door going to the Detroit Lions. John Simpson also going to the Jets. He's gone. That's three starters on your offensive line, and you just gave another starter a massive pay cut. Great that Tyler Linderbaum's still going to be there. And nice that you have some in-house replacements. You have Ben Cleveland, who might be starting for this team in week one. You have Andrew Voorhees. Remember, he was the late round pick. And what, a seventh round pick. And he's coming back from an ACL injury, kind of a redshirt year for him. You still have Saleh, even though he wasn't very good in the preseason. He's an intriguing option, but they're still going to need to add quite a lot between the draft. And frankly, I think they could still add a couple guys in free agency to the little short-term one-year deals that are incentive-laden, some veterans there, because this offensive line still needs some massive help, and they need to do it over the next 4 months before they get ready for the regular season.
Right. And the fallback from Ravens fans, the refrain is like, Eric DaCosta has a plan, and he definitely does. You don't trade someone like Morgan Moses if you don't have a plan. But how good is that plan necessarily going to be? Because you can take a first round pick on a lineman and still things could be shaky for half a year, the entire year and a half. You know, the Steelers took Broderick Jones, I think like number 16 overall. Last year, number 14 overall, you know, highly rated guy out of Georgia, was, you know, someone who was very, very accomplished, you know, first team all SEC the year before. And I don't think he played until like midseason. And that was a guy, yeah, he didn't make his first career start until week five against the Ravens. So you can have these very capable, very well thought of prospects, but there's no guarantee that they will live up to what their potential is, certainly in year one. I mean, we are just a year removed, or less than a year removed, from like Saleh being the supposed front runner to take over that left guard spot. And then the preseason comes and he's just absolutely terrible. I mean, like, I'm hopeful and I'm optimistic that year two is going to go better for him, but he was unplayable in the preseason. So there's always a jump from college to the NFL level. But when you are talking about what the Ravens have to do to have this season be successful, you know, right up at the top of every of every offseason to-do list is to have a competent offensive line. That was one of the first things that Lamar insisted upon when, you know, he was kind of becoming to have more and more of a voice in the organization. So obviously Linderbaum is good to go. You hope that Ronnie Stanley, with him being as diligent a worker as he is in the offseason, is going to be as healthy as possible for this next year. But three spots, man, that's a lot of spots to cover for. And there's no guarantee that any of those guys are going to be, frankly, as good as the guys they're replacing. It's a high bar, even for someone like John Simpson, who was a very capable run blocker, especially on some of those ones where he was just mauling people.
What's your question number six of our eight burning questions, Jonas?
It's a question that we know the answer to. Do the Ravens have any cap space left? Yes, they do. They have about $13 million, according to Brian McFarland, who keeps us well apprised at Russell Street Report. But again, considering all of the accounting that they need to do for draft classes and practice squad signings and rainy day funds, that $13 million doesn't really give you any flexibility until you start to pull some of those levers that the Ravens have at their disposal, like restructuring Lamar's contract. That's about $11 million in savings. Mark Andrews is about $5 million. Marcus Williams is about $7.2 million. But again, as with any of these simple restructures, which are not pay cuts, to be clear, not pay cuts, you are robbing from Peter to pay Paul. And not you, Paul, another Paul.
Please. Yeah.
And there has to be consideration, considering some of the contracts that are on the Ravens, you know, budget going forward and how relatively backloaded they are, that the more money you push into 2025 and 2026, the harder you'll make it for yourself next year. So I imagine they're going to have to restructure one of these deals, but you do not want to restructure all of it, because then again, you just find yourself inching closer and closer to that awful brink where you start to resemble the New Orleans Saints. And brother, you do not want to resemble the New Orleans Saints. You want to be as prudent, as effective, and as smart about your money as possible. And they're going to have to make some moves to sign some of these guys, whether they're bigger names, smaller names, middle tier names, but you have to be mindful about, you know, your outlay for the next few years as well.
The Saints are catching a lot of strays on this podcast, at least have during this offseason, used as a kind of anti-model organization when it comes to using cap space effectively. That question of number six, do the Ravens have any cap space left, leads into question number seven, which is, if they are to make extra cap space, if they are to restructure some of those contracts to open up some room, who could they use that extra cap space on? They need to improve their depth. If it's not, bring back Jadeveon Clowney, who is meeting with the Panthers, the Jaguars, and the Jets, reportedly. He may be as good as gone. Maybe it's bring back Kyle Van Noy on a cheaper contract. Maybe it's trying to get Emmanuel Ogba, who was in our free agency bracket, the former Dolphins defensive end. They need depth signings at the very least.
The thing to remember with all this is that you have to allow for the possibility of the mystery door, because there will be guys, probably more so after the draft, relative to the next month or so leading into the draft, who will get released, who become expendable because their GMs realize we drafted some guys who we really like, or we have some young guys who, you know, from what we've seen in offseason workouts, seem to be progressing pretty well, and those guys will become available. You know, Morgan Moses, I think before he signed with the Ravens, you know, was a surprise cut that the Commanders/Redskins picked up and did a pretty good job at. You know, there will inevitably be those middle tier guys, lower tier guys who become available and become pretty good options for you, because they are thrown into a market where a lot of teams have spent their money, a lot of teams have filled out their depth chart, and there's just not much of a need for those guys who might be fringy starters or capable backups or just older guys with a track record of perhaps not being 100% available every week. So yes, you know, Kyle Van Noy, I think, would be a good option for a re-signing. Yes, Jadeveon Clowney, if he's probably willing to take a bit of a hometown discount, would be a good signing. But there's also, you know, untold dozens of players who might become available over the next 2-3 months, who not only could be, you know, cost effective for the Ravens, but also fit into that framework of not counting against the Ravens' compensatory pick formula. Because right now, you know, you look at the Nick Korte, the Korte from Spot Track, or from Over the Cap, who does a great job with all the comp pick projections, has the Ravens, I think, with three right now, like a fifth, a sixth, and a seventh, somewhere around there, maybe a fourth, a fifth, and a sixth. And if you sign a guy before, what, July 1st, I think, or thereabouts is the cutoff, then you run the risk of disqualifying yourself from one of those comp picks. So the Ravens are going to be mindful. They're going to take their time. They're going to be patient and hopeful that maybe someone that we're not talking about right now becomes available and becomes a good option for them, especially on the defensive side of the ball.
All right, our final, eighth and final burning question, Jonas. You can take a look around the division at some of the impactful signings and ask, what is the most impactful signing outside of the Ravens in the AFC North?
Not just the AFC North. Well, let's talk AFC at
you
large.
Spread it out to the AFC? Sure.
I have a pretty easy answer for this about which is the most impactful signing, but just to recap, the Steelers signed Russell Wilson, traded for Justin Fields for, and they got both of them on the cheap. Obviously, they signed PQ to the three-year deal. The Browns didn't really do a whole lot. They did a good job of re-signing their own, brought back Za'Darius Smith on a nice deal, but they signed Jameis Winston to that one-year, $4 million deal. The Bengals, again, some significant losses, losing Chidobe Awuzie, losing DJ Reader, both guys who had been linchpins for that defense over the past couple of years. But somewhat replacing them, bringing in Sheldon Rankins for, a $12 million a year deal. Zach Moss, a nice budget signing for them at running back. Obviously, Geno Stone heading to Cincinnati on a two-year, $14 million deal. But then around the AFC, Bills, again, kind of strapped for cash. I think their big signing was Curtis Samuel, $8 million a year, which really is not a whole lot for a wide receiver. And then for me, I mean, it's probably the most obvious one. It's the most poignant one for Lamar. And for those early years of Lamar with him in Baltimore, it's the Chiefs signing Hollywood Brown. Relatively cheap deal, 1 year, $7 million, worth up to $11 million. But if you are talking about him potentially being the guy who could come in and be that upgrade on Marquez Valdes-Scantling, the field stretcher, the guy who will probably be able to catch more balls than MVS was able to last year because Hollywood Brown actually has good hands and MVS doesn't. But I think it's a good signing because the Chiefs probably have, I know they have the best Super Bowl odds in the AFC right now. They're right up there with the 49ers in general. And yeah, they're probably going to trade L'Jarius Sneed, but so many of the tentpole players of that organization are still in Kansas City. And now Mahomes gets another weapon to wide receiver core that was pretty bad last year, but still more than capable of freaking winning a Super Bowl.
Yeah, I think you drop Hollywood Brown on that team last year, and he's probably the second leading receiver behind Rashee Rice, who was their second round pick. Hollywood Brown has 1,000-yard receiving season so far in his career. Topped 1,000 yards a few years ago, just barely. I think he's going to do it again with Patrick Mahomes. Although I will say anybody with any modicum of talent, if the Chiefs were to bring him in at wide receiver, everybody would praise him and say, that's a brilliant move because of how little talent they had.
The McCole Harmon effect.
Exactly. How little talent that they had at that position last year. And also everybody is going to be playing with Patrick Mahomes. So he's going to make every single guy look good. I think Hollywood Brown will have a better year this year. That doesn't mean that he's a better player per se. He still has major flaws as a player, but his production at least could take a massive bump because he's playing with maybe the greatest quarterback ever.
We don't know exactly, where the Ravens and Chiefs game will end up on the schedule next year, but I think it's probably a pretty safe bet that it will be a primetime game.
Yeah, it's going to be a road game for the Ravens. We don't have the schedule yet. We will later on in the spring and summer, but that will be one to watch. All right, Jonas, thanks so much for tuning in. Everybody who is watching live on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, as we are live every week there, please give us a thumbs up, a rate, a review, a subscribe, all that good stuff. Subscribe to the BaltimoreBanner.com. $1 for 6 months to read all of Jonas's great work at Jonas_Schaefer. You can read Kyle Goon's work. You can read Gianna Han's work. We have more offseason coverage before we get into draft talk, probably at the beginning of April. But we'll have another episode for you next week if nothing major breaks over the next 7 days. I'm at Paul Mancano and at All Banner Sports. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Jonas Schaefer. I'm Paul.